Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Love Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 5th of October, these are our main stories. After months of wrangling, EU member states have agreed a plan to overhaul their asylum system. Hundreds of Israeli and Palestinian women have come together for peace rallies. The 2030 Football World Cup is to be played on three continents, opening in South America before moving to Morocco, Spain and Portugal. Also in this podcast...
It's stressful because you can't see them. They're coming out the night and bite you.
The bed bug panic gripping France as infestations soar ahead of next year's Paris Olympics. It's nowhere near the crisis levels of 2015, but the number of migrants trying to make the dangerous sea crossing from North Africa to Europe has surged this year, as have the number of deaths, with many taking to sea in small metal boats that the EU's border agency Frontex has described as coffins in water. Yet, despite this, the EU has remained divided on how to tackle migration, with Mediterranean countries like Italy, Greece and Spain arguing that they're shouldering most of the burden. Last week, a row broke out between Germany and Italy after Rome criticised Berlin for funding charities that rescue migrants and then bring them to Italy's shores. But now those differences have been patched up as member states have struck a new agreement on asylum and migration that will see countries either take in quotas of refugees or make payments to other nations. The European Commission's Vice President Margaritis Skinas said all member states must share responsibility.
It is morally, politically and legally unfair to delegate the responsibility for our external border to the five member states that geography has put them at the perimeter of our union. This is a collective task.
Spain currently holds the presidency of the EU Council. Our correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, told us more about this tentative deal.
This lays out the common stance of the EU countries. It lays out a sort of framework from which they will then go on and negotiate the details of a new asylum and migration policy for the EU when they start negotiations with the European Parliament. So it's a preliminary agreement, and that might make it sound sort of not very important, but it is seen by many people as quite significant, partly because these are issues that are difficult to get some kind of consensus on, and also because this is part of a broader position of the EU with which it really wants to overhaul European policy. What they've agreed on today deals specifically with how the EU will deal with migration and asylum crises in the future.
But there's not unanimous agreement, and this deal was almost scuppered by a row between Italy and Germany last week.
Yes, that's right. Italy and Germany were at odds over the issue of the use of and financing of NGO boats that were in the Mediterranean rescuing migrants. And that seemed to put a spoke in the works regarding reaching a deal for the whole EU. They actually managed to sort of hammer out their differences, and that is no longer a problem, that specific issue between Italy and Germany. However, regarding this latest agreement that has been reached, it's true, there was not unanimity. There was enough support for this to be approved by the member states. But, for example, Hungary and Poland, who, on the issue of asylum and migration, take a very different stance, they were opposed to this agreement. So, for example, a response from Hungary to this deal was quite angry, and it really didn't endorse it at all. Poland takes a similar stance as well. However, the countries that did support this stance, so for example, Spain, which holds the EU Council presidency at the moment, described this as a huge step forward. And the EU Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, described it as a real game changer. So you have some very contrasting responses to the deal that was hammered out.
And it does still leave many questions open, such as when and how it will be implemented ahead of European elections next year, when anti-immigration parties could do well.
Yes, I mean, the feeling seems to be that many of the member states that are involved in these talks on this want to get this approved, and they want to discuss this and get it approved by the European Parliament before the elections next year, because there are a number of countries that are seeing a rise of right-wing populism, which takes a very tough line on migration and asylum. So the feeling is that if this can be approved before that, then there will be much less political resistance to it than after the elections, which could see a political swing towards the right, or in many cases, the hard right in Europe.
Guy Hejko in Spain. Hundreds of Israeli and Palestinian women have joined together for peace rallies in Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank. Many dressed in white and held placards calling for an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with slogans such as "Stop killing our children." Mike Thompson reports.
The women's peace rallies come at a time of growing violence in Israel and the occupied West Bank, where the talk is more of confrontation than compromise. The resulting spike in violence has cost the lives of more than 200 Palestinians and 32 Israelis so far this year. On Wednesday, chanting, banner-waving Israeli and Palestinian women took to the streets, demanding an end to the killing. Some Palestinian women, unable to obtain permits to join the peace rally in Jerusalem, staged another one on the West Bank shore of the Dead Sea.
Mike Thompson. Now to the United States.
Yeah, I got love for my brother, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes, learn to see me.
The music of the hugely influential and charismatic rapper Tupac Shakur. He was gunned down in Las Vegas in 1996 at the height of his fame at the age of just 25. For nearly three decades, his murder has inspired dozens of books, articles and documentaries questioning why police appeared unable to solve the case. Now, 27 years after he was killed in a drive-by shooting, a man has appeared in court charged with his murder. Our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes, told us more about the suspect and what happened in court.
Dwayne Davis, also known as Keefe D, is 60 years old. He's a former Los Angeles area gang leader. He has long been a suspect in this case. This should have been what's known as the arraignment hearing, where he would have been asked to plead guilty or not guilty. But it was, in fact, postponed because a lawyer has only just been appointed to represent him. And Mr. Davis explained briefly that he wasn't able to be there, the lawyer, at short notice. So really, for logistical reasons, the hearing was put on hold for a couple of weeks. The new court date is October the 19th. Dwayne Davis remains in jail pending that hearing. He is charged with one count of murder with a deadly weapon.
So two more weeks to wait, but a lot of people are asking, why did it take so long for the authorities to even get to this stage?
Well, investigators say that it wasn't until recently that they had the evidence that they believe will prove their case. For many years, this investigation appeared to go cold. It went very quiet, although detectives insist that it was never abandoned, as some people thought. But things changed about 5 years ago. The case was reinvigorated, according to the authorities, when Dwayne Davis gave a series of interviews acknowledging his involvement. And then he wrote a book, Compton Street Legend, in which he said he was in the car from which shots were fired at Tupac Shakur's vehicle. The other three men in that car have since died. And in July of this year, investigators obtained a search warrant for Mr. Davis's home. Additional evidence was uncovered that paved the way for the indictment that we heard first about last week.
And Peter, why so much fascination with Tupac Shakur so many years after his death?
He was seen as a trailblazing artist, a rapper, a poet, very articulate, an inspiration to many people, the disenfranchised, many fans who felt that they were ignored by mainstream media. and music. He's sold over 75 million records, hugely popular. He was also an inspiration to other artists, people like Eminem. I remember covering his death at the time here in Los Angeles. There was shock, there was disbelief, and many conspiracy theories circulating about what could have happened. And I think for all of those reasons, that has just fueled the interest in the events of the last few days.
Peter Bose, as the authorities in Italy continue to investigate the cause of a horrific bus crash on the outskirts of Venice, they're looking into the possibility that the driver may have suddenly fallen ill. 21 people, including several children, died when the tourist bus suddenly plunged off an overpass late on Tuesday. Our Southern Europe correspondent, Mark Lowen, reports from the site of the crash.
At the spot where the bus took its last catastrophic journey, the impact of this crash is clear. The guardrails here at the edge of the overpass along which it was travelling are broken apart, smashed as the vehicle careered through, hurtling metres down to the railway line below, where it burst into flames. The bus was carrying tourists back to their nearby campsite from a day in central Venice, with Ukrainians and Germans among the dead, three of the fatalities young children. Beside the overpass, we met 27-year-old Boubacar Touré from Gambia, who ran to help when he heard the crash. When I arrived, a woman was crying, my baby, he says. I pulled her and her badly burnt son out of the bus. Then I took the fire extinguisher and tried to douse the flames, but it wasn't enough. I pulled others from the wreckage who were bleeding from their heads, he goes on. When people are dying and need your help, you can't simply walk away. CCTV footage shows the bus moving slowly up the overpass and then suddenly and inexplicably toppling off the side. The most likely cause, the authorities say, was that the Italian driver suddenly fell ill, causing his disastrous turn. Several of the injured remain in hospital, among them two young German brothers who lost both parents when the joy of a late summer holiday in beautiful Venice turned to unimaginable horror.
Mark Lowen in Italy. Next to football, and the world's governing body, FIFA, has announced that the 2030 World Cup will be jointly hosted by Morocco, Portugal and Spain. But Argentina, Paraguay and Uruguay will play their opening matches at home. The deal puts an end to the contest between the two rival bids. The three South American nations had claimed the right to host the World Cup to mark the centenary of the first FIFA competition, which was played in Uruguay. Ed Harry spoke to Martin Kesman, a football broadcaster at Universal 980 in Montevideo. So how has this announcement been greeted there in Uruguay?
People in Uruguay, you know, they love all the football. And having again this party about the world in sports is really a very nice news. And we are going to have the first match in our principal stadium that it's called Estadio Centenario, the first field that we construct for 1930. And we have the chance to have another World Cup inside 100 years later.
You mentioned it being a party. It's still, what, 7 years away? But just how big, now that we know it's coming, how big might those celebrations be to mark, as you say, 100 years on from Montevideo beginning the legacy of the FIFA World Cup?
I think that the party is to celebrate 100 about the creation of the World Cups in our country. But I can't imagine what is going to happen in the next 7 years. We have to imagine a strong squad. We have to imagine a good moment of our country in sports. So many items is going to be important to analyze in that moment. But now we are all illusionated with this chance to have the first match and the beginning of a new World Cup in 2013.
Match as well, of course, in Paraguay, in Argentina. Is there, though, any sense of disappointment today that South America hasn't been awarded the whole tournament?
First, the president of CONMEBOL, Alejandro Dominguez, explained why we can't be the all organized in the World Cup, because economical situation, because some other countries are best prepared than us in economical situations. But this is what we can organize and what we can afford. For Argentina, it's another stage to have a World Cup. In 1978, there were the organizers and also the world champions. In Paraguay, we never have the chance to have a World Cup. Chile is waiting also the chance to organize some matches. So I think that South America have to be happy because it's not a continent strong in economical situation, and we have to be available to organize what the FIFA give us as the chance.
The Uruguayan football broadcaster Martin Kesman. With the FIFA World Cup being held on three continents, there are also concerns about sustainability and the effect on climate change. Ed Harry also spoke to Dr. Madeleine Orr, an academic from the University of Toronto, who researches and lectures in sports sustainability.
It's pretty shocking, to be honest. You know, we heard a lot of talk after the Qatar World Cup that, you know, they wanted to focus on sustainability, that there would be consideration for carbon emissions moving forward in FIFA events, particularly after they came under so much scrutiny during Qatar. And then we get this announcement and it's essentially, you know, flying in the face of all commitments they've made on sustainability. So from my perspective, this is pretty shocking, but sadly not totally surprising. You know, they wanted to make a big splash. It's an anniversary, but it's still a huge problem. You know, the one thing they could do would be to ban fans from traveling to all these different places and focus on local fans. I just don't think they want to do that, right? They want to throw a party. They want to have this big celebration, and the result will be untold tens of thousands of flights all around the world. And that's the problem. There's no way to square a vision of a sustainable event, quote unquote, with kind of the footprint that is kind of doomed to come with this particular layout. If they're using old venues, they can maybe make some gains there. Whereas in Qatar, you know, it was tricky because they had to bring in not only new venues, but every piece of material had to come in, flown in from scratch, including everybody building it. So Qatar had a bunch of construction side issues and then, you know, flights during the event. But this, just flights, could absolutely topple that record. And we could see the most environmentally unsustainable FIFA World Cup on record.
Dr. Madeleine Orr from the University of Toronto. The BBC has asked FIFA for a comment on the issue of sustainability, but was told no one is available. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has announced that it's to bid to host the 2034 World Cup. The Saudi Football Federation said it intended to deliver a world-class tournament. The move marks the Gulf Kingdom's latest step to turn itself into a global sporting destination. Still to come on the podcast.
I'm determined to stick with my moral commitment to minimize the environmental impact of my work, so I'm not going to take a plane.
The climate researcher who says he's facing the sack for refusing to fly back from an assignment abroad.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
You are the only survivor. I say, how? What about others? See, they all died.
Expect the unexpected.
We were having a big, tearful discussion. How could someone ever do this? How could that ever happen? And that's the first time I ever came out with my story about how I was almost a school shooter.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. At least 10 people have been killed and more than 80 are missing after heavy rain caused flash floods in the northeastern Indian state of Sikkim. A hydropower dam was breached and more than 20 Indian soldiers are among those unaccounted for. With the details, here's our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etarajan.
Officials said a cloudburst over a glacial lake triggered the massive flooding in a mountainous area near the border with China. Videos on social media showed water gushing through the breached Chungthang Dam, one of the biggest in Sikkim state. Dozens of soldiers, villagers and labourers are missing, and the figures are expected to rise. Several key bridges have been washed away, and the main highway linking the state capital Gangtok with the neighbouring state of West Bengal being breached in several places. Environmentalists say the colossal damage to the dam is a reminder that such projects are not suitable in the ecologically sensitive Himalayas.
Ambarasan Etarajan. Now, a key moment in Canadian history. A member of the First Nations community has been elected leader of a province. Vaab Kanoe has been voted in as Premier of Manitoba. Canada is home to nearly 2 million Indigenous people, about 5% of its population, but they're severely underrepresented in Canadian government and politics. Our reporter, Peter Goffin, told us more about the significance of this election.
Wabkanoo has been in the public eye for a long time in Canada as a journalist, a musician, an activist. He's only 41 years old, but leading this left-wing party, the New Democratic Party, to power is just the latest act in a long career of Indigenous advocacy. Now, Manitoba is right in the middle of Canada. It's a vast, largely rural province, and like a lot of the country, it is sparsely populated. But 18% of the people who do live there are Indigenous, and that's the highest proportion of Canada's 10 provinces when it comes to Indigenous population. The main Manitoban city, Winnipeg, is home to more than 100,000 Indigenous people, and that's the largest single Indigenous community in Canada. And yet, it has taken 150 years for Manitoba to elect a First Nations leader. If you go all the way back to the 1870s, there was a premier who was Métis, which is a culture of historically mixed Indigenous and European heritage. But now here's Wabkanoo, a member of the Anishinaabe people who spent part of his childhood on a First Nations reserve, who campaigned to improve health care and cost of living as premier of Manitoba, and who speaks openly about turning his life around after struggling with alcohol and being arrested as a young man for assault and drink driving. Here's a bit of his victory speech.
I was given a second chance in life. And I would like to think that I've made good on that opportunity. And so to young people who are looking for a positive path, I want to share the words that my father always told us. Andobuachigek, seek your vision. Seek your vision. Dreams come true.
So, Peter, an important moment for the province of Manitoba and its new premier, but how about Canada as a whole?
Well, it's safe to say, Janat, that this is the most national attention a Manitoba provincial election has received in a long time. But Wabkanoo's victory has struck a chord right across Canada because Indigenous underrepresentation is a problem right across Canada. And there is a concern voiced by many Indigenous people that they're being left behind. Indigenous people, on average, in Canada have poorer health and education outcomes, higher rates of poverty and addiction, and higher rates of interaction with the justice system. Major inequities that need to be addressed. And, you know, we've been reporting for the last several weeks on Australia's referendum to establish an official Indigenous advisory body for its parliament. New Zealand has parliamentary seats set aside for Maori politicians. Canada doesn't have anything like that, but bit by bit, political representation at a high level is improving for Indigenous people in Canada. Two of Canada's northern territories are now led by Indigenous people. That's in addition to Wabkanoo in the province of Manitoba. The Governor General is an Inuit woman. These are steps towards giving Indigenous people in Canada the voice they want and the voice they deserve.
Peter Goffin. The Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg made headlines in 2019 when she refused to fly to a global warming summit in New York, instead spending 2 weeks at sea to get there. Now a climate researcher is facing a similar dilemma after his German employers ordered him to fly back from the Solomon Islands, where he's been working for the past 6 months. Dr. Gianluca Grimaldo says he could lose his job if he doesn't return to Germany immediately. Despite this, he's refusing to fly for environmental reasons. He told my colleague, Nuala McGovern, that he'd been due to come home last month, but his work in the Solomon Islands was held up.
After about 2.5 weeks, myself and my research team were victim of an ambush in which ex-combatants held us hostage under threat of machete, and they asked for a ransom for the release of all my belongings. Then we had another security threat of this kind, and that, of course, slowed down the whole process.
I mean, that's a very dramatic reason, and I'm very glad that you are doing well now. But let's get into the crux of this, which is, if you don't go back, you will be fired. Are you prepared to take a plane so that doesn't happen?
After 2 days of, I must say, very grueling meditation, I decided not to return by plane. They will probably, again, issue a request for me to come back in 2 or 3 days, and I will not go back. I'm determined to stick with my moral commitment to minimize the environmental impact of my work So I'm not going to take a plane.
So you are prepared to lose your job over this moral commitment, as you call it, to the climate?
Yes, of course. It's something that, many people will say that I'm crazy. Actually, I ask for some advice to friends, to other climate activists, and nobody told me you are doing the right thing. Everybody told me, take a plane, keep your job. Your job gives you enough economic stability in order for you to be able to pursue the climate cause in different ways. But I said to myself, I really cannot do it because this moral commitment that I have is too strong. I want to sound the alarm because I do think that we are in a terrible situation with respect to our climate. So I just think that what I am doing actually is not crazy, but it's the right thing to do because it is instead crazy that we keep on with business as usual.
The BBC asked Dr. Grimalda's employer, the Keele Institute, for an interview. They said no, but told us, we remain committed to our policy of not publicly discussing or commenting on personal legal matters. In general, the Institute encourages and supports its staff to travel in a climate-friendly way. And we paid CO2 compensation for all business trips made by our employees by air. Indonesia has the second highest number of TikTok users worldwide after the United States, many of whom use the e-commerce feature TikTok Shop. But now the government has forced the social media app to remove the shopping feature following protests by traders in Jakarta who say it is damaging their business. This trader, called Siamsel, has a store in Indonesia's biggest textile market, Tanah Abang.
Almost nobody buys. It's fallen drastically. I don't know about the others, but from my own experience, it's been like that. I've lost at least 95% of my usual profits, only gaining 5% a month. I can barely afford food with the money, much less pay the rent to operate in this building. I have to pay for the service charge, the electricity. I used to have an employee working here, but now I don't anymore. I had two shops. One of them I had to shut down because I couldn't afford the service charge. I went through a whole month without a single buyer, no income at all.
But some business owners in the country have embraced selling online. For more on what led to this TikTok shopping ban, my colleague Vivian Nunes spoke to Tricia Dantiani in Jakarta.
The traders in Tanah Abang market in central Jakarta, which is the largest textile market in Southeast Asia, they've been in dire conditions since the pandemic and also with the rapid growth of e-commerce and even more so with social commerce, which is TikTok Shop. We've spoken to a number of sellers who do business in the market and they admitted that they've been losing revenue. Around 30 to 95% of their offline revenue has been hindered by the existence of these sellers on TikTok Shop because the products that they sell there, the prices are unbelievably cheaper compared to the same products sold offline. That's why people prefer to buy them online instead of going to the markets. They've been holding these protests and putting up signs demanding that the government close down TikTok Shop, and the government has spoken.
Okay, so a victory for the market traders in the capital, Jakarta. But what about the millions of Indonesian small business holders that have been using the platform to sell their wares?
Yeah, there has been a bit of, I would say, resistance from TikTok because, yeah, they say that they're helping these small, medium businesses. But on the other hand, it's also not regulated as well, the small, medium businesses online. Last time I checked the app, people are still trying to sell their items. And I just opened the app a few minutes ago and they were saying, okay, TikTok Shop is going to close. So we're sort of like a sell all. They want to sell. They want to finish off their stock. They want to sell all their items in one go before the app feature closes. They also have other avenues actually, because other than the TikTok Shop, they also have Tokopedia and Shopee and those other e-commerce apps. And usually sellers have multiple accounts on different platforms. So I think that's why there hasn't been that much of an uproar against this ban.
Tricia Dantiani in Indonesia. The Olympics often come with jeopardy. Will costs overrun? Will things be ready on time? Will there be a boycott? But next year's games in Paris are dealing with something rather more unusual, a fear of bedbugs. There have been increasing reports of the blood-sucking insects on trains, in cinemas, and infesting people's homes. And one television presenter was even accused of racism after suggesting migrants might be to blame. So serious is the problem that sniffer dogs have been deployed, as Hugh Schofield reports.
Set a dog to catch a bug. Ollie, the Springer Spaniel, has been specially trained to sniff out bedbugs, and right now he's looking for a whiff in a Paris flat. The owner, Jacques de Chef de Bien, has been bitten, and so is his wife. They're so spooked, they threw their bed into the street.
It's stressful because you can't see them. They're coming out the night. You see, I'm sleeping on the floor, and knowing that maybe there are some little insects that are coming out from the floor and bite you. No, it's difficult to live with that.
Jacques' case is one of thousands in France at the moment. Pest control companies are stretched to the limit. And it's not just beds that the bedbugs are frequenting. There are stories, unverified but plausible, of bugs in cinemas and on trains.
Une vague de panique saisit le pays. Les punaises de lit prolifèrent dans tous les lieux du quotidien. Les hôpitaux,
it's got so bad it's turned political. On Tuesday, one MP brandished a capsule of bedbugs in Parliament as she demanded government help for bedbug victims. Experts say things are bad, though perhaps not quite as bad as they're portrayed.
During the last 10 years, like in most big cities in the world, we have seen an increase in bedbugs infestation.
Nicolas Roux de Bézieux runs a bedbug control company.
Basically, it's doubled every 5 years. But right now, we also have kind of a mediatic bubble. Of course, there is a real phenomenon behind it, but it's not as big as the media could let you think in France, actually.
Down in Marseille is France's main medical research centre into bugs and insects, and I was shown round by chief entomologist Jean-Michel Béranger. He too says there's definitely been a resurgence of bedbugs in recent years, mainly caused by the movement of people around the globe. But because previously they'd largely been eradicated in France and other developed countries, their return now is creating something akin to panic.
When you talk to old people, they can remember bedbugs, and they say, oh yes, we did this or that to get rid of them, and it's not a big issue for them. But today, now that bedbugs are back, people living in our very sterile modern world are panicked and a bit lost.
What we're doing is an experiment now, and Dr. Béranger has very kindly placed a tiny young bedbug on Dr. Béranger says we need to demystify bedbugs so we're not quite so freaked out by them. And one way to do that is to see them in action. And that's what's happening here. He's put a bedbug on the back of my hand.
So it's a weird sensation because I feel absolutely nothing. I can just about see this speck on my hand, but on the computer with its blown up, I don't know how many hundreds of times, I can see that this thing gorging itself with my blood and pumping my blood into its body.
Hugh Schofield in France, going above and beyond the call of duty to report impartially on bedbugs. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Uncover from CBC Podcasts is your source for exceptional storytelling and groundbreaking journalism. Unveil the shocking secrets of one of Canada's most prolific fashion moguls. Dissect the events that led to the city of Philadelphia dropping a bomb on a family of American citizens. And dive into the unsolved murders of two Canadian billionaires. The very best in award-winning true crime. Uncover, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.